It's Tuesday, April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the fate of millions of U.S. immigrants may rest with a court decision. New York, if leading presidential candidates make it there, they hope to make it anywhere.
Right now, we are trying to satisfy the basic needs of the people.
Ecuador and Japan each cope with massive earthquakes. Also ahead, Brazil's economy slides amid a presidential impeachment. Jazz great Miles Davis at the movies. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Supreme Court has heard opening arguments in a case that could affect the fate of as many as 4 million undocumented immigrants. The eight justices are expected to issue a ruling by the end of June on the legality of President Barack Obama's executive actions on immigration, actions that 26 U.S. states, led by Texas, are challenging at the top U.S. court. VOA reporter Catherine Gibson followed the proceedings Monday and told International Edition host Michael Lippin what it was like to be at the highest court in the land.
Well, it was my first time inside the Supreme Court, and it's interesting how they set the journalists up for big cases. We're kind of behind a screen, so you have to listen very closely to what the justices are saying. And it's very interesting to hear the different arguments go back and forth and hear the justices interrupting the lawyers as they're arguing the case. It was a unique experience, that's for sure.
Well, what did we learn from those justices about their feelings on this case and how they might rule?
Right. We learned that this case will most likely hinge on one key phrase in President Obama's executive actions, and that phrase is lawful presence. His executive actions say that there's a lawful presence for these undocumented immigrants in the United States, and that because of that, they then have access to work authorizations, driver's licenses, all sorts of other benefits. Now, the Texas lawsuit is arguing that that effectively creates new immigration law, and that's beyond the president's authority.
Well, what are the justices asking about that specific phrase, lawful presence?
They were saying, you know, what's the difference between lawful presence and legal presence? And there are differences in immigration law between those two terms. And their questions were to the point, if these undocumented immigrants are being granted lawful presence in the United States, are they effectively being granted a specific immigration status? If it does create a new immigration status, then the president doesn't have the ability to do that. That's a new immigration law. And that's not what he's supposed to be doing. That's Congress's job. So that's really what all of this is going to hinge on and how those justices read that phrase.
Well, what did the people outside the court think about these proceedings? Because I understand you had a chance to speak to some of them after the arguments wrapped up.
Right. So I spoke to two or three demonstrators out of this very lively crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people, some who came from all around the country to be at the Supreme Court today. And they really spoke about what a personal impact this decision would have on their lives, their ability to live and work and have children and raise families here in the U.S. It's really a turning point in their lives.
Were there any protesters from, you know, the other side of the argument in favor of the lawsuit that the states brought against Obama's executive actions?
You know, not that I saw, but it wouldn't surprise me if they were there. I would say that the demonstrators on the side of the undocumented immigrants were very vocal, very lively. They certainly had a lot of different chants going, si se puede, meaning yes, we can. And it's possible that they were drowning out the other side.
Well, I understand you did a Facebook Live from outside the courtroom.
Right.
How did that go today?
Right. Well, you know, Facebook Live is this very exciting new thing that we can do from the site of these news events. And it was interesting to be able to walk around and show the crowd of demonstrators and have a very immediate feel like you are taking the viewer right there.
Well, what kind of feedback did you get from the viewers?
Oh, no, they just say that it's nice to see the Supreme Court, and it's very interesting to have kind of a personal VOA face on that story.
Well, thank you very much to reporter Catherine Gibson for telling us about today's proceedings at the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
We turn now to our social media segment. G. Abby Lee follows for International Edition what the online reaction is to our top story. Welcome to the studio, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the trending hashtag?
It's hashtag #FightForFamilies. This hashtag is used by people who support President Obama's plan to keep families of undocumented immigrants together. So far, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is the only presidential contender to use the hashtag. She tweeted, "It's time to create a path to full and equal citizenship and finally fix our broken immigration system." And she signed it with letter H. Other trending hashtags include DAPA and DACA. The first refers to the deferred action for parents of Americans and lawful permanent residents, and the latter, deferred action for childhood arrivals. These are the programs the White House announced back in 2014.
Right. And what's the buzz like on our website?
Our reporter, Catherine Gibson, who we just heard from, filed a report titled "Supreme Court Hears Case Deciding Fate of Millions of Undocumented Immigrants." There is a lively discussion in the comments section, and some people had an issue with the terminology undocumented. One person wrote, "Stop calling them undocumented. The fact that they are illegal aliens is well documented. Stop sugarcoating." Another person chimed in and argued, "The law is clear and that it is a responsibility of the executive branch to enforce the laws." Only one comment defended President Obama, and that reads like this: "If Congress stubbornly refuses to do their job for 8 years, then somebody has to. Obama's orders on immigration were legally correct and proper."
I see. So who are you following to keep posted on the news?
Well, neither the White House nor President Obama tweeted about it, but I am following a Wall Street Journal reporter who is following the story very closely. His handle is @JessBravin. That's B-R-A-V-I-N. He tweeted a link to the journal's real-time blog about the story, which accumulates tweets from three reporters who are following the story. In the tweet, he used hashtags DAPA and DACA. Jim, back to you.
Well, thank you for the social media update, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I post daily as well at VOA Stevenson. And as always, we invite you to follow the International Edition stream. That's found at VOA_IE. The two presidential frontrunners, Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump, are in a New York state of mind, as you might say, as they look ahead to the latest and a very important presidential primary in the Empire State. Both Clinton and Trump are favorites to win in New York, and victories would be a major boost for their campaigns on the road to the White House. We hear more now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
For Republican Donald Trump, a big win in his home state could be a major step towards securing his party's nomination.
On Tuesday, you have to go out and you have to vote. You have to get your friends, because we have a movement going on. It's a movement like they've never seen in this country.
Trump looks to rebound after recent losses to rival Ted Cruz. Cruz argues that Trump's negative image with many voters would lead to a Republican defeat in November if he becomes the nominee.
Nationwide, about 70% of Republicans recognize that if Donald Trump is the nominee, Hillary Clinton wins. Hillary beats Donald Trump by double digits. If I'm the nominee, we beat Hillary.
But Ohio Governor John Kasich says he's the best candidate to beat Clinton and hopes to win some delegates in New York with an optimistic message.
Because we risk losing everything from the White House to the courthouse to the State House if we don't advance a positive, uplifting, unifying message to this country. That is what we need to do.
In the Democratic race, former Secretary of State and New York Senator Hillary Clinton is also looking for a home state advantage.
If you will go out and vote for me on Tuesday, I will fight for you during this campaign, and I will fight for you every single day in the White House. Thank you, and God bless you, Staten Island.
Financial fraud became not only the norm in many ways.
Rival Bernie Sanders took time off the campaign trail to speak at a Vatican conference on economic inequality, a core theme of his campaign.
I believe from the bottom of my heart that I am the stronger candidate running against a Republican. And I think more and more Democrats understand that as well.
But even if Sanders loses in New York, he'll continue to have a big impact on the Democratic race, says Michael Williams.
he is honest in the extreme. He is oddly appealing with his disheveled, frumpy look. Will he win? No. But has he affected this race and the course of the Democrat Party for the long term? Oh, certainly he has.
New York victories for Clinton and Trump would solidify their status as the clear party frontrunners. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you can see the video that goes with Jim's report at voanews.com, or if you happen to have a smartphone, by using the VOA mobile app. And we encourage you to join us again tomorrow as we will have results out of New York. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff is vowing a long fight against possible impeachment after the lower house voted late Sunday to recommend a trial in the Senate for alleged corruption. Rousseff said during a televised news conference that she's outraged. The House voted 367 to 137 in favor of impeachment, and it sent the matter to the Senate, which now plans to vote next month. Rousseff is accused of manipulating the numbers to make the country's budget deficit look lower than it was during her 2014 re-election campaign. But her administration is also blamed for the country's severe recession. International Business Times economic reporter Carter Doherty joins us to discuss Brazil's economic woes as the nation should be looking forward to the Rio Olympics.
Well, Brazil has faced quite a turnaround in the last 7 years or so. It really was riding high when it won the right to host the Olympics. You had new offshore oil discoveries, a big boom in the economy, which was powered in part by China's voracious appetite for Brazilian raw materials like oil and iron ore. And you also had a president Lula, Luiz Inácio da Silva, who was very, very popular, not only with the working class, people who helped put him there, but even with the business class, which appreciated his stewardship in the economy. Now you fast forward 7 years, and you have probably the worst political crisis in Brazil since the return to civilian rule back in the mid-late 1980s. You have an economy that's really facing a harrowing recession. And the political backdrop to that is the impeachment of the current president and her apparent involvement in a very wide-ranging corruption scandal involving the state-owned oil firm Petrobras. But the notable thing about Brazil in this case is that it's long had a certain culture of corruption, but you have a new generation of judges and prosecutors who are revolting against this notion with the full support of the population. So whatever you can say about Brazil at this point, about its own self-inflicted wounds, the institutions are working, and that's a promising sign.
Brazil's deficit seemed to be under control back when the Olympics were announced, but the budget deficit has soared since then.
That's right. You had a time in which Brazil was riding high, the commodities boom, really strong economic growth and falling unemployment. And the current government of Dilma Rousseff really didn't prepare during the sunny days for the inevitable rainy days that would come. And so now they're facing a certain degree of reckoning, which some of which was predictable.
And one of the key indicators, too, in the economy, as you mentioned, is that foreign investment is way down in Brazil.
That's right. And that's been a harbinger of things for some time now. That's, again, an unfortunate turnaround because investors really were starting to have quite a bit of faith in Brazil given the boom over the past 7 years. I will say that Brazil is a very large place. We're talking about a country that's the size of the continental United States, blessed with bountiful natural resources and a talented people. So I think longer term, there's no question the place bounces back. But for the moment, on the eve of the Olympics, it's a grim picture.
And there are a lot of possibilities where Brazil can hinge its future fortunes on. Of course, one of the so-called BRICS nations. How would it fit into that as far as a turnaround and working with the other economies that it has been associated with?
Well, you can see lots of potential for prosperity in Brazil. Principally, you do have a strong middle class, a middle class that has a political voice and will demand that government be cleaned up. You will eventually have a rebound in the oil price, and that will help Brazil's energy industry. It also is blessed with some of the richest iron ore deposits in the world, easy to mine, cheap to mine, and that ensures the shakeout in that industry that Brazil will stay ahead in the sense that it's always going to be a leader in that industry. So shouldn't forget as well farming soybeans, the area to the south of the Amazon River Valley, one of the richest soybean growing areas in the world. So tremendous potential there that obviously will take some time to manifest.
International Business Times senior international economics reporter Carter Doherty. You can find his article online, Road to Rio, Brazil's Path to 2016 Summer Olympics Paved with Turmoil. Carter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ecuador and Japan are engaged in rescue and relief operations following strong and devastating earthquakes last week. Ecuador suffered a 7.8 magnitude quake Saturday along its Pacific coast that left more than 270 dead, including at least two Canadians and hundreds more injured. Japan was rocked by two major quakes Thursday and again Saturday. The most powerful was Saturday's 7.3 magnitude quake. Both struck in the southern island of Kyushu. Gabriela Benitez with the humanitarian agency World Vision in Quito, Ecuador's capital, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that she felt the quake 170 kilometers from the epicenter near the tourist city of Pedernales, which was the hardest hit community.
Thanks, God. We have no damages here, but we have a lot of problems in the provinces, especially in Manabí province and Esmeralda province. We also, as NGO, we are coordinating all the efforts and all the response with the local authorities and also with the humanitarian team of the country.
What are the rescue efforts underway?
Right now, we are trying to satisfy the basic needs of the people, which is, for example, bottled water, also medicines, because the hospitals are full of people which are sick and which have cuts because of all the things that have been falling down because of the earthquake. We are helping the authorities to make all these distributions. We are trying to make fundraising to be able to support, because even though there are a lot of humanitarian agencies and local authorities working in the zone, in the affected zones, but as you know, these kind of events are always superior than our capacities to respond and to have a big coverage.
The area most affected is called Pedernales. It's a tourist spot with beaches and palm trees. What can you tell us about that?
Pedernales is totally destroyed. Rescuers are trying to rescue people from under the buildings, the hotels, and everything that is completely destroyed, that city.
Ecuador, of course, is in the Pacific Rim where earthquakes are prone. Is this the biggest quake that you can remember in Ecuador?
Yes, sure. It's the most biggest earthquake during the last 30 years.
Authorities have declared states of emergencies in the hardest hit provinces. Thousands of soldiers have been deployed to keep order. Several neighboring countries have also sent rescue personnel and supplies. Ecuador's last major quake 29 years ago killed about 1,000. Meanwhile, in Japan, where the two quakes were followed by hundreds of aftershocks, Asian studies professor Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo says the Japanese are pretty accustomed to such natural disasters.
You know, back in 2011, about a month before the major quake struck,
There have been a series of volcanic eruptions down in Kyushu that lay a thick layer of ash over wide areas. And here it then a month later, there was the big quake. So, you know, I think that everybody in Japan understands that their time will come at some point. It is a country that is often whacked with horrible natural disasters, tsunami, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. One thing that seems to be encouraging is so far that the only nuclear power plant that has been restarted is actually located just over 100 kilometers away from the epicenter. And so far, the reports are there have been no malfunctions, no problems.
Factories for major manufacturers such as Toyota and Sony and Honda were closed. Are there going to be supply chain disruptions around the country as a result?
Yes, I think that the damage to the infrastructure, landslides are blocking major roads, train service has been disrupted, there have been interruptions in water supply and electricity and gas, so that a number of companies have announced temporary closings. And early estimates are that economic cost of this quake will certainly be well above $10 billion.
Jeff Kingston adds that the damage to the Japanese economy will likely be minimal. The U.S. military is also assisting relief efforts. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Actor Don Cheadle is making his directorial debut with his film drama Miles Ahead. It looks at the tumultuous life of iconic trumpeter Miles Davis. Cheadle focuses on the musician's visceral talent, inner demons, and sense of humor in a film noir type of thriller. It's complete with car chases, shootouts, and drug addiction. VOA's Penelope Palou has more.
If you gonna tell a story, come with some attitude, man.
Attitude is at the core of this Miles Davis biopic.
I want it to be gangster. I want it to be wild. I want it to be impressionistic.
Miles Davis. My name's Dave Braden, Rolling Stone magazine. I'm here to do your comeback story.
Okay, move back a little bit.
Yeah.
The film portrays Davis in the late 1970s during his fallow period, a recluse with physical ailments and a cocaine addiction.
It's based on a lot of incidents, you know, like any biopic. There, you know, characters are composites and they're amalgams. A lot of that stuff happened, you know. Miles did make a secret recording that was, went missing. He was shot in a drive-by. He had many reporters coming to him during this period of time trying to get the story.
This is madness. I am not dying over this jazz tape.
Don't call it jazz, man. That's a made-up word. It's social music.
Through flashbacks, the film juxtaposes an older, paranoid Davis with his younger, confident, though arrogant self, at the top of his game. We learn of his emotional dependence on his then-wife, talented dancer, Frances Taylor, and his abusive behavior towards her, both physically and emotionally.
I need you.
Cheadle does not sugarcoat Davis's transgressions. He loves the music icon for who he was and portrays him as a soft-spoken yet intense character. Ewan McGregor, who interprets the reporter shadowing Davis, grounds the fraying icon to present-day reality. Chittle calls his teaming with Ewan McGregor a great artistic experience, but also a necessary pairing with a white star so he could get his film off the ground.
I would have more difficulty financing it unless the actor that I picked had an international appeal. And having Ewan McGregor and sell to the UK was a huge piece of the pie that we needed in order to get the ball rolling.
On the heels of the Oscars' so-wide controversy, Chittle neither defends nor chastises the industry. A pragmatist and a celebrity himself, he sees Hollywood as a big business, averse to risk and fear-based.
You're black?
That does not mean he defends its typecasting stereotypes. Hollywood, he says, does not take purposeful aim against blacks and other minorities, but its decisions, he says, can lead to racism and bias all the same. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us anytime you like at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter, giving you the latest updates on just about anything that's happening in the world. Follow us at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us. Come back when you can. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Africa Logistic Forum is an example of how the United States can support African nations to examine and explore continuing logistics challenges in Africa's security sector, said U.S. Ambassador to Ghana, Robert Jackson. Speaking at the opening ceremony of the Africa Logistics Forum in Accra, April 12th, the ambassador noted, "The forum focuses on analyzing the existing logistic gaps, explores practical applications, and surveys sound principles for effective logistics management." The United States, he said, continues to recognize the importance of the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center. The center's mission to provide training, education, and research to foster peace and stability in Africa is vital and has impact on real lives throughout Africa. The center has already trained more than 11,000 people from diverse organizations in essential aspects of peacekeeping operations. "The United States' main objective," said Ambassador Jackson, "is to support African nations with all required assistance. It is imperative to have experienced personnel with the right equipment and training if we are to overcome the logistical obstacles we face in garrison, operational, or tactical environments." "Our Ghanaian partners have been a major contributor to the United Nations peacekeeping operations," he said, "supplying more than 3,000 personnel, including police, military observers, and troops, in the past 8 years. Exercises such as the Logistics Peacekeeping Operations and the African Deployment Assistance Partnership Team, conducted in Ghana, Togo, and Benin in the last 2 years, have been essential for training logistical units and personnel." The Logistics Peacekeeping Operations is a training event focused on logistics before, during, and after peacekeeping operations. This exercise covered sustainment principles, including preventative maintenance checks and services, subsistence and field feeding, general supply, transportation, distribution, as well as logistical estimates. In addition, the African Deployment Assistance Partnership Team bridges the gap between limited deployment capacity to participating nations in peacekeeping operations, humanitarian response operations, and contingency operations. Ambassador Jackson told the forum participants that the United States and the nations of Africa share a common destiny. "I am confident," he said, "that work like yours will allow us to marshal the tools necessary to craft partnerships and, as Kofi Annan said, to face our goals together."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for, what's